Take a network break. Sit back and lick the virtual jelly out of your virtual donut as we sift the information streams for gold nuggets of tech news. I'm Drew Conry Murray. Greg Farrow is on the other end of a Skype call, and we've got a few sponsors for today's show. This episode of Network Break is brought to you by ExtraHop. ExtraHop is the leader in real-time IT analytics and the pioneer of wire data, the ultimate lens into digital transactions. ExtraHop provides insight from the data center to the edge device to cloud, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. Tweet at ExtraHop and mention Packet Pushers to get a free t-shirt. Network Break is also being brought to you by Viptela. If you're in Las Vegas at Interop, you're invited to a live event on Monday, May 15th at 6:30 p.m. in the Centrifuge Lounge in MGM. We'll have food, drinks, and conversation. You can sign up at viptela.com/centrifuge, and we'll see you in Vegas. This episode of Network Break is also being brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and for a limited time, 50% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription, visit itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK50. All right, Greg, our first story of the day is that VMware is selling off vCloud Air.
Yeah, so this is something that's been telegraphed for a while. VMware, of course, had its public cloud offering back in the days when it was fashionable to own public clouds. You remember those?
I do, yes. Everybody
had
one.
It all does seem so far ago, yeah. So we saw that when VMware is being acquired by Dell, or the merger with Dell, or the, you know, whatever you want to call it, acquihire, cash deal, whatever you want, VMware said that it would get rid of the vCloud Air. Now, there's a lot of confusion here. A lot of people don't understand that there's the vCloud Air, which is the VMware-owned public cloud, and then there's the vCloud Air network, which is a range of resellers and third parties or VMware partners who've set up public clouds using a VMware stack, so they have to work in a certain way. There's a very big network of vCloud Air network partners that continues, but VMware has sold the thing that it owns, the public cloud of vCloud Air, to OVH. Now, you've never heard of OVH, because it's a European cloud hosting company. It's been around for quite some time. It's one of the largest hosting companies in Europe. It has had American footprint. It's been attempting to grow that business. So by buying this, it obviously gets a whole bunch of assets, a whole bunch of customers to go and whore their salespeople to, you know, to attempt to try and convince them to stick with the business and turn it into a vCloud Air network partner. And generally, this is one of these companies that's going to hope to get big or die trying.
So I don't have a sense of how successful or not vCloud Air was. Do you have any details on that or rumors or anything?
Its success was modest. When vCloud Air first started, it was quite a popular thing. And then all of a sudden, it was like all of the companies had public clouds and they were being heavily promoted and customers were actively switching. And then all of a sudden they went, oh, this is harder than it looked. Oh, and we need lots of money. We need to build 30 or 40 data centers around the world over the next 20 years, and we're going to have to drop, you know, like 20 or 30 billion into this to compete with and, you know, we're actually competing directly with our customers, and there's lots of, you know, oh, well, you know what, you know, and VMware is ultimately only like an $8 billion business. It's not actually that big a company. So asking them to cough up tens of billions to build out our public cloud network was like, we're not going to be able to build this out of cash flow, and it's not going to grow 5% per year. It's going to be like 100% per year, requiring massive upfront investments. And yes, I think, it's, you know, OVH wants to get big or die trying, because hosting providers are being drastically undercut by Azure, Google, and AWS in the Western world, of course, and in China, it's Alibaba and so forth. So this gets rid of it. They get $3 billion. Dell gets $3 billion to pay down even more debt and satisfy its private venture capital owners, of course.
All right. Well, we'll see how this develops, but I guess good for OVH.
Yeah, I think it was a few things here. One is Dell needs the cash. They want to pay down their debts.
We'll talk about that a little bit later too, yeah.
And getting rid of this, OVH, of course, doesn't have a U.S. business, you know, or has a very small U.S. business and wants to grow it. So there's lots of synergies. I imagine there's lots of transitional agreements where OVH promises to look after VMware's customers and take good care of them, which is actually short speak for make sure that you give them a service offering until they reasonably forget that we were the ones who flogged them this thing in the first place. and that's about it, really. Yeah.
All right, so the next story for the day, AT&T has announced that it recently completed field trials of white box switches the company developed in partnership, and they were working with vendors like Broadcom, Intel, and EdgeCore, and startups like Barefoot Networks and SnapRoute.
Well, you know, there's certain parts of the press that jumped onto this like a hungry dog on a T-bone steak. And, you know, they thought a breakthrough, it's been hailed as a revolution. I'm going like, oh, hang on, boys and girls. AT&T has been headed down this path for quite some time. You know, On this show, we've been telling you that AT&T has been pushing its open source credentials over and over for, what, 2 years, 3 years now?
Yeah, quite a while.
This is like about as predictable as flipping over 30 cards and one of them's going to be a king. It's about as predictable as flipping over 30 cards and one of them's going to be a king, right? It's just going to happen. Right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What makes this interesting, I think, is when you read the article, and we'll have links in the show notes, which is it took AT&T just 3 months to build not one, but two white boxes.
Yeah, two white boxes on separate platforms, yeah.
Exactly, right? And they didn't do it themselves. So just in case you're thinking, how did AT&T do it themselves? They didn't. Of course, AT&T is big enough to go out and drag the vendors kicking and screaming into the room and get them to do most of the work. So that's what they did. A bit like what Amazon and Google have done for white box in their own ways. So as they say in the blog post, several visionary companies helped us to bring it to life. Barefoot, Broadcom, Delta, EdgeCore, Intel, SnapRoute provided the standardized hardware and open source software that powers these network switches. Right? So it wasn't AT&T as much as AT&T with a big juicy T-bone steak and a bunch of hungry dogs going, oh, yeah, I want some of that.
Let's do it, yeah. Yes.
The end result was two switches, one based around the Delta Agamar switch using Broadcom Coomeron silicon with SnapRoute network operating system, and then one of the EdgeCore switches based on the Wedge design from the Open Compute Foundation using Barefoot's Tofino silicon, which we've talked about very recently. So not just one silicon, two different silicons, two different switch makers, two quite different operating systems, but SnapRoute's actually got their networking, their flex switch operating system onto both of these. So that's quite a coup for SnapRoute, I think.
Yeah, and for Barefoot. I mean, also for AT&T, because they said they set up these switches in the East Coast and the West Coast and started sending traffic between them. So two different platforms, sending packets back and forth, that's what you want.
Yeah, they haven't just done it live. Like, they haven't just built the switches and then said, hey, we've got these white box switches. They've actually put them in live and they're running them for live traffic, according to the press release, right? So while it surprises me that a service provider is leading with white box, I would have thought that white box would have gotten into the enterprise faster. But it seems the enterprise is very resistant to saving money. And I've sort of come to terms with that. But, you know, 3 months, that's shorter than a Cisco product meeting.
Badoom-tsh.
I mean, Cisco's, I've spoken to Cisco product managers, and making a decision in 3 months would be seen as something short of miraculous, just short of miraculous, if indeed it's ever actually happened in the history of the company, you know, like getting people around and executives to sign off and blah, blah, blah.
Well, this is exactly the benefit that the open source and white box community talks about, this ability to turn things over quickly, move production faster, speed up the cycle of development and innovation, because you're not based on a particular vendor's timescale, a particular vendor's cost constraints, and a particular vendor's business strategy. You're assembling kit yourself, essentially.
That's right. And keep in mind that all of these are commodity components. SnapRoute runs on Linux and the applications. So it's not just SnapRoute's open network operating system, because that's just Linux. It's SnapRoute apps on top of an open NOS, right? And the rest of the chassis themselves, like even the EdgeCore 100BF, is based on a Wedge hardware design. So it's not like they had to invent everything from scratch. Everything exists.
Yeah, that's the whole point. Yeah, it's Legos that you pull off the shelf and snap them together. And
that's right. Or in the case of Delta's of Agamar, they just took an off-the-shelf switch and started running SnapRoute's NOS on top of that. There was nothing to be invented here, nothing to be built. This is all commodity components coming off the shelf, just like any x86 server. You get it, you put something on it, and boom, it starts installing your apps, and away you go. I certainly think that AT&T's laying out its business strategy to improve its buying power and driving its IT vendors to reduce their prices. I mean, AT&T has been very clear that they need to drive reductions in buying. They need to get reductions in buying their assets. So using a self-defined white box is certainly a part of that strategy, and it's going to be signaling to the IT vendors who supply them, you know, the networking companies like HP and Cisco and, you know, all of the companies who make Ethernet switches are saying, we can do this ourselves. If you don't come to the table, we will do it ourselves, right? If you can't give us the pricing that we expect to pay going forward, well, guess what? We've just got a competitive product which we can use instead of yours.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely part of it, that you know, pricing pressure you can put on your vendors. And part of the appeal of Whitebox is that it's geared toward being run like a fleet of servers. You've got automation tool sets that you can tie it into. And we also talked about AT&T being very strong on open source software because they're trying to embrace NFV and streamline their operations. And so Whitebox totally fits into that strategy.
Yeah, that's right. And there's two things here. The second one, obviously, is that they get control of the NOS and the features that are in the NOS that suit them, so they can start to add their own telemetry, start to add their own IOs or their IPIs. They get control of the pipeline so they can put the features in there that they want. They get control of the quality. So if they need to iterate the operating system in a very short time frame, they don't have to wait 6 months or a year for the Junipers, the Ciscos, and so forth to go through there. Do we want to fix this? Is it worth fixing this? Put it into the pipeline. 3 months later, the fix is made. Then 3 months later, the testing is done by the outsourced third-party testing company, blah, blah, blah. No, this is about speeding up that time to market there. And with things like Cord and ONOS, we've seen a lot of noise this week around with the ONS conference in San Francisco. Lots of announcements there around ONAP, Cord, and ONOS. AT&T doesn't want itself to be beholden to the big vendors to deliver APIs and features. They can now start to put this box in and say, we own this. We can add this feature at a time that works for us. And boom, they're in control of everything again. So I do think this is a really significant shift, but not something that's going to change everything overnight. This is going to be a very gradual building up. And the fear for the big vendors must be if AT&T builds up muscle here, builds up skills, builds up capabilities, builds up vendor relationships, and actually displaces the Ciscos, the Junipers, and all of the existing proprietary vendors out of their network. If AT&T can build up that muscle and its own capability, if they don't head this off early enough, then AT&T will just go and do it all themselves.
That's right. Yeah, and another thing that jumped out at me is AT&T really harped on the telemetry information they were able to pull out, and that was in partnership with Barefoot, talking about how not only is it great for their operations, but they could see it potentially enabling new applications and new business uses, which, again, part of that whole white box, build it and specify it to your specific needs. That's another thing that it's hard for the traditional OEMs to do.
That's right, yes. And the OEM, but, you know, the traditional manufacturers aren't iterating at a speed anymore. They're sort of stuck. You know, you're actually seeing the vendors attempt to put features into products and then waiting to sell them. Every time they add a feature, they expect more revenue to come from that feature being added to it. And that's not the way the market's working anymore. It's very much a, if you don't have these features, your products don't work.
That's right.
The old days of the, you know, you need to have these features to be in the market. There is no more revenue to be gained by adding more BGP features or adding more MPLS features. No one's going to pay you more for those. You have to do these to stay in the game. And in fact, you better be at least doing that, if not dropping your price by a substantial amount, 30 to 50% to be competitive with Whitebox, because some of their biggest customers are just going to start building up the capability, building up muscle, working out how to do it themselves, and working with smaller players who can do this faster, quicker, and probably better because they're using more modern tooling, more modern management practices, better quality executives. You know, everything about smaller companies is better suited to speed, and they can just outcompete them. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out.
Yeah, I have to imagine that this release maybe not be world-shaking, but it must be causing consternation up and down boardrooms in Silicon Valley.
I'm sure that the big vendors are aware that this was coming. It's not like this.
Right. It's not a surprise. Yeah.
It wouldn't be a surprise to them because they would be dealing. But I think the wider sales forces in these big companies, you know, I would always, in the past, I would have said Brocade, Juniper, Cisco, but Brocade's gone away. You know, they must be very concerned about this sort of thing. And it starts at AT&T and then it goes down. Because what we're seeing, of course, with Whitebox in the data centers is we're seeing the big players, the Facebooks, the Amazons, the Googles doing Whitebox and making their own switches. But we're starting to see that trickle down to the second tier. And those people are starting to say, you know, we can use Whitebox in some places in our data center. And that's very interesting, I think.
Yeah, something we'll keep an eye on. But let's move on. There are major tech players bidding to purchase Toshiba's NAND flash memory business. That list includes Apple, Google, Amazon, and Western Digital. And just to give you a sense of how much money we're talking, Investors Business Daily reported that Broadcom and Silver Lake Partners have teamed up to offer nearly $18 billion to Toshiba for this business unit.
So this is the consumer market. You know, the companies that are lining up here are wanting to get their hands into a business that makes flash memory. And you're looking at a very odd thing like Apple. You could say, well, they want to own the supply chain. Sure, they do. And Apple has increasingly been about this vertical integration. So, you know, we'll talk about HPE divesting itself again. But Apple is one of the companies who's been vertically integrating its supply chain, buying GPU, buying licenses to ARM, making its own silicon. And it wants to own a fab or be a part of an owner in this fab. And Google and Amazon are lining up. So what these companies are actually doing is, instead of disaggregating their supply chain and saying, who's going to own this? They're saying, we're going to go and buy the thing that makes our RAM, our flash RAM and our DRAM. That's going to be very interesting, I think.
Yeah, Apple I can see, Broadcom, definitely I can see Western Digital makes sense. Google and Amazon, I'm having a hard time reconciling that.
Well, they're one of the biggest consumers of flash memory today.
Sure.
Right? So why don't you get your hands on the supply chain and start influencing the supplier directly at the boardroom?
That's obviously an upside, but you could also say then, well, why don't they buy a switch company? Why don't they buy a routing company?
Well, they don't have to. To make a switch, they don't have to, you know.
But they don't have to buy flash either. There's a bunch of people making flash. It's a very competitive market.
No. There's only three or four companies making flash memory. There's literally only a handful. It's a very small market. It requires $5 billion to build a factory. It takes 4 years for the factory to come online.
Okay, so they get advantage of those sunk costs. They don't have to put it out for that and then have a little bit more control over their supply chain. Okay, I guess I can see that.
That's right. And then they can start to leverage pricing too, because if they own Toshiba, they can start leaning on Western Digital and the other Samsung, you know, and so forth, who own the fabs, to actually start getting the price under control and smoothing out the supply chain. Keep in mind too that flash memory for the next 2 years is very constrained. The factories just aren't able to produce enough flash to keep up with demand. And there's talks about there being a genuine shortage of SSD drives. So maybe this is a way of getting the supply locked in for them. So it's not obvious. You'd think, why would Amazon or Google get into the flash memory? And I think it's because they want to make sure they've got control of the supply chain, which is exactly the opposite to what you would normally hear.
Right, exactly. All right, well, we'll definitely keep an eye on that and see how this bidding shakes out. I want to take a brief moment to tell you about ExtraHop, one of our sponsors for today. ExtraHop is a leader in real-time IT analytics, pioneering wired data. That's the window into digital transactions. They provide insight across the entire IT environment, from your data center to the edge to the cloud, which helps you make data-driven decisions to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. For too long, IT has thought of the network as either the plumbing or the problem. With ExtraHop, the network actually becomes the biggest source of real-time visibility. That's because ExtraHop does the analysis first and stores packets later. That creates wired data, which encompasses all the interactions between IT systems and the organizations that rely on them. Wired data is rich, real-time, observed, and objective. Analyzing it at scale transforms the network from just a transport function to the foundation of your digital experience. To learn more about ExtraHop and try it for yourself, visit them at extrahop.com/demo. And if you connect with them on Twitter at ExtraHop, mention the Packet Pushers and get a free t-shirt. ExtraHop, it's instant insight for IT.
For all you lovers of packet captures out there.
There you go. Packet Capture Plus, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. That's what they do, for sure.
And back to the news, there's a new open source project called the Free Range Routing, and it was recently announced. Free Range Routing, or FRR, is a fork of the Quagga open source router. It's designed to run on Unix and Linux and supports a variety of routing protocols, including BGP, ISIS, and OSPF.
Yeah, so very interesting here. This is one of these, Quagga is an open source routing project that's been around, well, for an extraordinarily long time, sort of even in the days when open source routing was definitely unfashionable.
Yeah, exactly. It's de rigueur now, but yeah, Quagga's been doing it.
Yeah, that's right. Everybody who thinks, you know, there was definitely a time when it was uncool and thought to be highly risky and bad juju for your entire network just to run a piece of open source everywhere, anywhere in it. Whereas now we're seeing people use Quagga as critical business, especially IXPs, for example, are heavily dependent on tools like Quagga to be BGP reflectors, route reflectors. So for Cumulus to lead a group of people, now it's not just Cumulus here, there is actually a substantial group, but to take Quagga and fork it sort of highlights the challenge with open source. There's always two extremes of open source. One is people standing up and saying, open source doesn't do what we want, but damned if we're going to contribute because it doesn't do what we want.
Sure.
Because it doesn't do what we want, we're not about to start spending money getting it to do what we want. That's the very common one from customers and IT managers. It doesn't do what we want, so we're not going to spend money on allocating headcount to writing the code that makes it just do that last few things we actually think are important, but that nobody cares. So I always get a bit angry about that one. But the second one is when certain organizations say open source isn't moving fast enough for us, or it's not going in the direction that we want. So all of a sudden we fork, and now we can get control of it and move it at our place. Now, when you fork an open source project, you always incur a certain amount of risk. There's a lot of people who've been working on Quagga for, 10 years or more. Why would you fork it? You really, really want to have something to make you want to fork it. Have you got any view on that?
I actually had an opportunity to talk to J.R. Rivers. He's the founder of Cumulus, about this. And he said they worked very hard with the Quagga organization. They had devoted money and resources inside Cumulus to working on this open source routing project. And they felt like, as you mentioned, it wasn't moving at the pace or in the direction that they felt was sort of common now for the way open source projects are going. And he cited this metric to me saying that Cumulus had 3,000 patches for Quagga in a backlog that the Quagga organization just hadn't been able to get to. I haven't talked to Quagga to confirm this. So his frustration and other people's frustration was that there are things we want to do here, things we know we can do here, and it's just not moving fast enough. So while we know forking is, you know, sort of frowned upon in the open source industry, we just feel like we got to do this. So they banded together with other folks at Six Wind is involved, Big Switch, Orange, and a few others, and said, we just got to take the code and put it into an organization that's going to be more responsive, a little faster, and develop it in a direction we want.
Well, and see, as a fork, this is probably going to be successful, because if Cumulus looks like it's got a club of its friends going and then took all their friends with them, and if those friends are actually contributing resources to the project, then, you know, Quagga might actually just die because, you know, the key resources that were moving it forward have suddenly quit the project.
Well, speaking of resources, they also got it as a project within the Linux Foundation, which puts a little bit of muscle behind it in terms of, you know, trademark and some organization as well.
And also, anything in the Linux Foundation, it's very fashionable for enterprises and service providers to regard that favorably. As a custodian, it's regarded as a fine institution that can be more or less trusted on these things. I'm a little bit, you know, more free range on that idea, so, shall we say? Do you see what I did there?
Well done, sir.
Oh, on fire. Yeah, a Linux Foundation is a positive, and certainly as custodians, it lays out, you know, clear lines of ownership, clear lines of who owns what and process. And, you know, if you do have a deep grievance, you inside the project itself. And then, so for enterprises, that is a positive. You're not dealing with a benevolent dictator who might necessarily have everybody's interests at heart, might just have their own. I think that's a positive. Yeah.
And just as a note, Cumulus says that it's going to use an upcoming version of FreeRange Router as its default routing suite in its Cumulus Linux network OS. So it's definitely got some plans there.
Yeah, I can't see this as a bad thing. I do agree that open source projects can be problematic. And I do know that Cumulus has been committing a lot of resources to Quagga for a very long period, years. They've been contributing patches and code and support and people, and the frustrations have been building up over some time. So imagine it's just got to the point where they felt they had to go out of it. But at the same time, sad to see long-standing projects get terminated, basically.
Right, to split up resources that way is a kind of a bummer.
Yeah, everybody loses.
But if you're interested, we'll have links to where you can check out the code for yourself, download it, play with it, and also a blog from the Linux Foundation welcoming FreeRange Routing to the foundation. In other open source networking news, DPDK, that's a project to accelerate packet processing and CPUs. It is also now officially a Linux Foundation collaborative project.
Yeah, DPDK is, of course, the hardware acceleration for networking that Intel's been building into its processors. I've seen a lot of people get fairly bent out of shape about DPDK, saying it's not open source, it's Intel owns it. And there's a certain amount of hostility from certain corners of the Linux community about DPDK. I think most of them think that XDP is going to be much better suited to what they want it to be able to do. And I think DPDK was being a little bit orphaned because of that process. So now that it's in the Linux Foundation, maybe some of that bile might be ameliorated. But I suspect that it's going to be interesting to see whether DPDK and XDP and eBPF is the other thing as well, which one of these is actually going to become the default API for moving packets around inside the operating system. I suspect DPDK might be over, and Intel feels that it's lost control. And by moving it to the Linux Foundation, this is either like, okay, we're done with it, we've lost, let's just park it, or it's a last attempt to try and get on board with the people. A little hard to tell. I haven't got any contacts inside of Intel anymore because the people I know all moved around. So that would be just speculation.
Yeah, I don't have any more insight into it either, but it does seem like another notch in the Linux Foundation's hat in terms of being a sort of a power broker or a dealer for the open networking movement.
Yeah, well, there's two ways of looking at the Linux Foundation. By the time it gets to the Linux Foundation, the project might be over, and the people who've been the momentum behind it have decided to walk away, and they just want to get, you know, they don't want to see their baby die, but also on the other hand, they don't actually want to keep the puppy anymore. So sometimes it can be a place to just go and park something that's dying. The other place it can be is to take it to the Linux Foundation and give it some ownership between a large group of commercial companies, because commercial companies don't want to own it themselves and manage it themselves. They need a structure and a process. And, you know, if you're Cumulus and those companies that we're talking about before, Six Winged and Cumulus, who did the free range routing project, they want to be able to have a place where their disputes can be heard and grievances can be aired and processed in a known way. So there's two ends of the Linux Foundation, then just be careful about which one is which. So it's not necessarily a positive or a negative that DPDK has gone to the Linux Foundation. It's hard to tell.
In a previous episode of Network Break, we had reported that HPE was spinning off its services division and combining it with CSC. That process is now officially complete, and a new entity has emerged. It's called DXC Technology.
Isn't it funny how the fashion for business changes over the years? And it was just a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, it was the absolute tip-top of business fashion from our world-leading CEOs to go and buy professional services companies and be just like IBM. Everybody was looking at IBM and saying, you know, if only we had a professional services arm like IBM, we could make, you know, mucho bucks and be in full control of the customer. The goal, of course, with a professional services organization is that you actually take full control of everything the customer does, because your professional services is, you're advising, you're not advising the customer, you're just moving in and taking out the entire IT team and putting your own headcount in. And so all of a sudden your professional services team, you know, if you're HP or IBM, you can choose to start selling HP hardware over competitors' hardware, you know, maybe Dell's. And so this was going to be the way. And then, of course, IBM started to falter, and it became clear that IBM's professional services business model wasn't actually a success. They'd been propping it up with some fairly dodgy accounting. Finally, Gina Rometty wasn't actually able to hide that under the rug anymore, and IBM's continuing to struggle with its share price and its revenue numbers because the whole professional services business is collapsing. Right. And so this is the same thing's happened to HPE. HPE bought a bunch of companies like Enterprise CSC and had bought several professional services companies and intended to weld them together into a team. Never really took. And so now they're spinning out the professional services. I think this makes good sense overall in the current fashion.
Right. And HPE isn't entirely walking away from this. I think they still hold a significant share of this new company. And Meg Whitman is on the board of DXC.
Yeah, they'll want to maintain some, just like VMware with the sale of the vCloud Air, they'll want to maintain some control to make sure that their brand is protected and that their customers don't blame them when something goes wrong later on. So it's not like, we sold it. Good luck, boot.
Right. Yeah, so long.
You don't want to damage your brand as you exit customers because you want to stay in contact with them. You're not getting rid of these customers. HPE still wants to sell these customers servers and printers and, you know, servers and storage arrays and networking products. They just don't want to sell the professional services anymore to integrate them and deploy them. Now, what was originally the pure feature of owning a professional services company was, of course, fatally flawed, because professional services only works when they can make the choices that best suit the customer. So if you start dealing with one company's professional services, they only sell one product, and everybody says, you're only selling this because you own that product. And of course, that's exactly why they bought them. And apparently customers are smarter than that, and that's probably why this went south. There's enough dumb customers, though, doing business with IBM, so, you know, IBM has disproved the model for many, many years. But cloud is starting to eat away. It's an all-or-nothing business model. If you're going to own professional services, you've got to be all in with it. You can't be just dabbling with it and trying to pick up 10% growth. It's got to be the whole thing. It's interesting to note that Cisco went partially down this path. Cisco started to wind up its professional services engine as it was clear that, you know, these other companies were moving down this path. But Cisco never really committed to it. It always wanted to. It was very reluctant to upset resellers and disrupt the cash flow and the profits that come from letting resellers take products to market. And at one time, it looked like Cisco was going to miss the boat. And then, of course, the fashion proved out wrong. So Cisco's come out of this relatively unscathed. They're scaling back their professional services arm, I think, to throw the emphasis back onto resellers selling products to customers and not trying to set up its professional services arm. But it was, you know, less than 2 years ago, Cisco was winding up its professional services arm as a way of getting recurring revenue. So how the fashion turns, eh?
To note, this is still a significant size business. DXC has 170,000 employees and $26 billion in annual revenue. So it's not a small undertaking.
No, not at all. It's going to be a significant, you know, the customers that have these contracts. I mean, I was at one company who signed a 10 to 15 year contract with HP in the day to supply desktops, printers, data centers, headcount, blah, blah, blah. So you, just because 3 or 4 years into the contract, you've decided to walk away from it. That's not, you know what I mean? Like that's a problem. Yeah.
There's some late tail there. Yeah.
There's a long tail here. And I've heard of companies supplying, you know, long-term contracts that, and none of them really worked, by the way. All the people I've seen who actually have outsourced this stuff to these professional, it just doesn't work. It's generally a miserable failure, not just for the customer, but for everybody involved. Like the people who are on the professional services side, they just never know whether they're coming or going. So it's outsourcing is a miserable failure, and it's being wound up across the board. So don't expect this business to fire.
All right, we have to take a brief break to tell you about an upcoming event at Interop, party being sponsored by Vipilla. Greg, you can tell us a little bit more.
Yes, so we are going to be at Interop ITX Code doing the conference there, but we are going to be having a special event there with Viptela. Now, you know Viptela is one of the leading SD-WAN companies. They've been on the show several times. We've talked about their software-defined WAN strategy, and they're doing big things. I was talking to somebody the other day, and a little bit of gossip here for you. One of Viptela's biggest customers has over 6,000 sites on their software-defined WAN. So don't tell Viptela I told you that, right, by the way. But we're going to be joining Viptela on the Monday evening. That's Monday, May the 15th. We're going to be having a little bit of a party. So if you're going to be at Interop, come and join us and other networking people from the conference there with food, some drink, and some great conversation. Bring us your questions, challenges, and any questions, you know, future things, and then we'll mingle with you and have a chat. You can say hi to myself. Obviously, Greg, Ethan, and Drew will be there as well. And you can ask us questions. Maybe you've got things that you've always wanted us to do. What we want you to do is to go over to viptela.com/centrifuge. That's C-E-N-T-R-I-F-U-G-E, because that's the name of the bar. And this conference is in the MGM Grand, so it's not in the usual location. We'd love to see you in Vegas. So that's Monday, May 15th, 6:30 p.m., straight after the conference finishes on the Monday. So you'd have to be in that track. It's going to be at Interop ITX in Las Vegas. Join us at the Centrifuge Bar for some drinks and our walk around and some snacks, and we'd love to see you there.
That's right. So go to viptela.com/centrifuge to sign up to make sure you're on the list. Last year at this Viptela party, Greg, I think you were walking around with a selfie stick. So just fair warning for folks.
I was. It was so much fun to play with, too. We got some great photos.
Got some good stuff.
And I got to meet people. Like, people were flying into the Interop conference from all over the world and came to the Viptela party just to be able to say hi to us. And that was a real special thing for me and for Ethan. And to be able to just, you know, these people who, like, you know, people listening who we'd never see. And we never hear from you. We love your emails and love or talk to us and hear what's going on in the real world and make sure that we are in touch. So, you know, if you are coming to Interop ITX, make sure you come to the party. If not, go over to Viptela's website and check out their products. They've got great stuff.
All right, back to the news. Dell Technologies reported its quarterly financials. They posted $20.1 billion for Q4 and $61.6 billion for the full fiscal year. They also posted an operating loss of $1.7 billion for the fourth quarter.
Yeah, so it looks like it's a little hard to decode these results. And because Dell's not a publicly listed company, nobody's doing a decode and helping me to, you know, understand right. What this means. But I think the key thing here is that they actually managed to grow their PC business 11%.
Yeah, 11%.
Which is extraordinary in the face of the fact that the industry is pretty much shrinking at around about 5%. So they didn't just grow it, they grew it while everybody else was shrinking. So that's a really substantial win. So I think it's very interesting. I mean, they seem to have paid down a fair bit of debt. I think they've got more to go. And on the whole, Michael Dell seems to pop up on his Twitter account every now and then and goes, the best thing I ever did was take my company private again. So the financial results would certainly suggest that they're in fine form. But it only includes 52 days of revenue from EMC and VMware. You sort of forget how long these mergers take, don't you?
That's right. Yeah, just 52 days is pretty surprising considering how long we've been talking about it.
Yeah. Still, one of the biggest mergers ever, and Dell seems to have really hit it and got it working so far. There's no signs of it fracturing or not working. I'm sure there's plenty of internal problems. I've heard that inside of Dell, things are still fairly messy. People don't know who they are and where they are, and there's a lot of staff exiting for competitors because they just don't want to get messed around. But I think on the whole, Dell's doing it quite well.
Yeah, and just a note, Dell took on approximately $57 billion in debt to make this acquisition. And for this quarter, they've reported that they paid down $7 billion so far. So still a ways to go, but they are chipping away at it.
I hope that's actually paid down on the principal, not just the interest.
Oh, my goodness. We took out a balloon loan, so interest only. My goodness. Oh. Okay, just a quick break to tell you about our sponsor, IT Pro TV. With IT Pro TV, you'll gain access to the most important tools needed to prepare for your IT certification. IT Pro TV offers over 2,000 hours of content and more than 125 hours of content streaming live every week. You can stream courses live and on demand from their website or to your Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, or your PC. Upcoming course topics include Managing the Lifecycle and Microsoft Hello for Business. Transcripts let you follow from start to finish or jump to any part of the video. Take advantage of IT Pro TV's low monthly subscription price and no-hassle cancellation policy. IT Pro TV has introduced a new standard membership level, giving you access to all the live and recorded video content only. A premium annual membership includes all video content, as well as access to virtual labs and Q&A forums. The cost is normally $85.70 a month or $857 a year, but we have a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. For a free 7-day trial and for a limited time, 50% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription, visit itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK50. That's itpro.tv/networkbreak with the code NETWORKBREAK50. And thanks IT Pro TV for being a sponsor. All right, moving on. Cisco CEO Chuck Robbins, he is becoming an independent board member at BlackRock. That is an investment management firm. They've got approximately $5 trillion in assets being managed. And according to a BlackRock press release, Robbins is being brought aboard for his insights into how technology is transforming global business.
Must be boring to be the Cisco CEO, huh?
He's got some free time.
He got some free time. Like a $50 billion company isn't really enough fun. So he needs to go in.
A $50 billion company versus a $5 trillion company. I guess he's like, what's going on over there?
And it's not as if BlackRock doesn't have like a lovely, clean reputation. It's been involved in all sorts of dubious activities over the years.
My understanding is that being on these boards is lucrative. And I'm sure having a big, you know, financial firm come and say, Mr. Robbins, we'd really love to pick your brain on some technology things. That's also got to be flattering.
Yeah, I suspect it's an ego thing. And once you get to that level of money when you're the CEO of Cisco, how much more do you actually need after that?
Just ask those people at BlackRock. I'm sure they've got plenty of ideas on how to spend it.
That's right. Mostly these people take these opportunities once they get to the top because it's an ego thing. I'm the biggest and the bestest. And that's why, obviously, I am the biggest and the bestest. Therefore, I must be, blah, blah, blah. On the pride side, it is only Chuck Robbins' first external commitment after being elevated to the top at Cisco, of course. And keep in mind that at the end of the day, Cisco is a boring business, right? It's not innovative. It's not doing new stuff. It generates substantial dividends. And if you do want some excitement as the CEO of a boring company, what do? Go somewhere else.
Go sit on a board somewhere else and see what's going on.
Exactly. So this is what John Chambers did. And for those of you who remember when John Chambers took his eye off the ball to go off and play, he played politics and then got onto the boards of several other companies. Cisco started to falter. I would be reasonably concerned if I was a Cisco shareholder that this might be history repeating itself.
All right, this is something we'll keep an eye on. And last but not least, a follow-up to our coverage on how in the United States, ISPs have had restrictions removed on selling customer data. Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T recently released statements saying that they will not sell individual browsing histories. They will continue to sell aggregated and anonymized information.
Yeah, but that's never really worked out so well, has it? So I would imagine that Comcast and Verizon aren't selling individual data today. That doesn't mean that they won't tomorrow, right?
Well, I think I'm trying to parse the Reuters story that said this and what the statements are. I think essentially what they're saying is a marketing company or a credit reporting agency can't walk up to a Comcast or a Verizon and say, hey, I would like to get the browsing history of Greg Farrow. How much does that cost? What they're saying that we won't do that because we respect our customers too much, but we will sell you a bucket of information around technology professionals who live in this region who happen to be interested in the following things, and that could include Mr. Farrow.
Which is not far removed from what Google and Facebook are doing today.
Absolutely. The whole impetus for this was the ISPs complaining, well, why can't we do it? Because all these web providers are doing it and it's not fair. My take is I'm not paying Google and Facebook for their services, so I'm trading a little bit of my privacy. I am paying Verizon for my internet service, so I feel like I should at least have the option to opt out of them reselling me.
Yeah, but ultimately these companies have already been selling your data. I've said several times that I've got an article which points to this being a $24 billion market in 2015. They were already doing it, right? And part of acquiring Yahoo and AOL was to be able to link the content with the data that crosses their own backbone. So while they might not sell third parties the individual data, I'll bet they'll do it individually, internally. Right? If you're all a Verizon company, maybe they're not selling it. That's just inside the company. So there's all sorts of ways this can be exaggerated, misinterpreted, reinterpreted in their own favor. I am fairly sure that they won't sell individual data, but do remember that there are people on Facebook who say, I'm looking for a person who is a technologist who lives in this postcode, who is white, middle-aged, and that actually limits you to about one person. Right? It's very easy to pick up just one person in a group using non-individual data.
Sure, not one, but you can certainly narrow it down very quickly.
Yeah, yeah. Remember that story? There was a story about 2 years ago, I think, where this guy decided to start mucking around with his friend, and he went onto Facebook and started buying ads, but he made the criteria so specific that it was actually only targeting one person, and it kept putting this ad up saying, "I know what you did last night." And, you know, just and his friend really started to freak out, and then he stopped, and then he'd wait a week, and then he'd come back in and say, "I saw what you did." You know, the ad would come up and say, "You did this last night."
I am delighted to hear you say this, because there had been a couple of movements on, you know, can we go out and buy data on the Congress people who chucked our privacy for some campaign donations? And obviously you can't go and say, "I want, you know, Congressperson X's web browsing history." But we could set up a fund and buy ads to target people who happen to work in the Washington, D.C. area, you know, at these kind of addresses, and maybe post some ads like, "Hey, I know what you're up to. Hey, why'd you go there last night?" That would be a lot of fun.
You know, the thing that worries me is, while the personal angle is a concern, if I was a security person and I knew that my internet feeds, like crossing Verizon's network or Comcast, and I'm using them for my branches, what happens if that data is included in this? And what's going to happen there? There's actually a serious security risk there.
I think so. And I think we'll find out more about the ramifications of this as we go. And I don't think it's going to be good for consumers or businesses that aren't ISPs, but we'll see what happens.
Sure.
Well, on that distressing note, that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
You can find me on my blog at ethereumline.com, where I'm microblogging these days. But of course, my more serious content is at packetpushers.net. And you can find me making various noises on the Twitters as at ethereumline.
And I'm Drew Connery Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I also blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsors, ExtraHop and Viptela. And thanks to you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share a link with your colleagues. And please do check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find those and lots of fine free technical podcasts at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.